Talk about your years with Robert Turner.
So my years with Robert Turner really date from 1979-1980 down to the time in 1992 when I became consultant physician and took over the clinical services in Oxford. So really just over a decade. Robert Turner was a brilliant person to work with. He'd fish me back from Central Middlesex because I'd done 3 months of research with him. He'd written to me again and again about coming back and finding me some funding and so on to do research. I wasn't trying to do a DPhil, I was just a postdoc. And we did a very large amount of work on the control of insulin secretion and a large amount of work on insulin resistance. We looked at pulsatile insulin delivery using all of the mathematical tools that I'd picked up during my time with working with Roy Kay. And over that time, I picked up a junior research fellowship at Balliol and then a senior research fellowship, the Joan and Richard Dole Senior Research Fellowship at Green College. I was the first person to hold that post. The JRF in Balliol was one of those things that I applied for, and they just said, come down and meet us over lunch as a sort of preliminary. And I wandered down to Balliol to have lunch with the people there in 1982. And I talked to these people casually over lunch, and then they just said, oh, just pop over here now. And they led me into a room where there were, I think, fully 15 to 20 fellows all in a semicircle with a chair in the middle for me to sit in, and suddenly realised that they were going to grill me. I hadn't prepared for any of this. I remember to this day the square wave change in my adrenaline as I suddenly realised that they were just going to grill me. Anyway, I must have done reasonably well. They appointed me as JRF. And it was an honour too to be made senior research fellow at Green College. Colleges were very different in their ethos. The Balliol was full of very political and important people, and always interesting to dine there or to have lunch there. And Green College was didn't have that breadth of membership, tended to have just medics. So from that point of view, it was less eclectic than Balliol. The work on pulsatile insulin delivery went very well. We did a lot of mathematical modelling, of which a thing called the homeostatic model was part, and that was published in 1985. That was a large amount of background work went into producing that model, and in fact it's the most widely quoted mathematical model in diabetes to date, and has got huge numbers of citations. I think currently about 8,000 or 9,000 citations in the literature to the model from that particular paper. Now let me just tell you about Robert Turner, because there aren't many people who work for someone for a decade as a postdoc. Robert Turner was an amazing clinician and physiologist, and was interested in mathematics and genetics and clinical care and devices and so on. Interestingly, he was very poorly recognised as being a shining light in Oxford until much later in his life, in fact, nearly too late. And it was years and years before Oxford got round to giving him a personal chair, which was a continuing disgrace, considering that he'd taken over effectively the Department of the Regius Professor of Medicine, because at the time that Sir Richard Dole took over as Regius Professor, Richard Doll didn't need anything except an office and mathematicians around him. He was that sort of epidemiologist. And there was a very active laboratory that Robert took over and did large amounts of insulin assays and so on. Robert having trained both in Cambridge and in Boston. Robert was a delight to work for, always enthusiastic, always interested in what was going on, not prone to silly outbursts, very even-tempered, charming in many respects. Infuriating in some, in that if he wasn't very interested in what you had to say, then a sort of portcullis would come down over his eyes, and so he actually almost literally wouldn't be listening to what you were saying. I think you could have just said rhubarb, 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 and Robert wouldn't have noticed. So there were times where you just thought, well, I might just as well stop talking, and indeed you did stop talking because Robert wasn't listening. And there was the extent to which Robert wouldn't change his mind, so he was pretty stubborn about things. And that stubbornness was the major force behind the success of the UKPDS, because people kept telling him that there was no more money, and he would then just ignore that and just get money from other places. I mean, the British Diabetes Association, it was then, repeatedly said that he couldn't have any more research money, and so Robert used to just say, well, that's their opinion, but I'll write to the trustees, and used to just circumvent the research committee and say, this is so important that you need to pay, and they did. To the fury, of course, of people who are running the research committee, to say, what's the point of a research committee if we say there shouldn't be any more money? But Robert used to do all of those things and get money, squeeze money out of all sorts of people to keep all of that going. A great enthusiast, managed in his time to be really the trainer of a huge number of people who ended up in key posts around the country and in other places. So Professor Steve O'Rahilly, for instance, came through the laboratory, and Professor Andrew Hattersley was there. Jonathan Levy, who was my clinical colleague in Ockham, worked with Robert. And of course, Professor Ruri Holman, who not only was key to the UKPDS, but went on to found what is now the biggest clinical trials unit in diabetes in the world, running out of Ockham, and all trained through Robert. Added to that, there was Tim Davis, who was a contemporary of mine, now professor at Fremantle in Australia, and a large number of other academics who've ended up in various positions around the world, and who are still luminaries there. So Robert really managed to have a sort of engine of not only training people, but actually finding and identifying the sort of people who would work with him. Very exciting to work alongside all of those people, and very entertaining too. Within those years, lots of extraordinary things happened. I suppose some incidents are worth recording. We did start off being more amateur in research than one would be these days in terms of standard operating procedures. So research was easier to get underway. These days, it's absolutely strewn around with so much bureaucracy that it's extremely difficult to do clinical research now, very difficult to fund, and very difficult to get off the ground. But it was easier in those days, though of course everything went through ethics committees. But there was one occasion when we managed to, by making a mistake over refrigeration of some preparation to give an infusion of the bacteria E. coli to a medical student who then had a rigor in the middle of the night. So that was a thing that we shouldn't have done. Luckily, we filled him up with antibiotics and he was all right. People used to faint sometimes with research, And I did say earlier that I used to faint, and so I was sympathetic to that. The reason that I eventually stopped fainting, if I can just reflect back into that as a during an anatomy session, was that on one occasion in anatomy, the group of all four of us were taken aside from leaning on the cadaver that I mentioned, to taken over to a skeleton, and the demonstrator was trying to teach us about the structure of the skeleton, and I came over in my usual peculiar way of thinking, oh my goodness me, this is a skeleton, and started to faint. Philip Holm, I said, I'm going to faint. Philip Holm said, in that case, I'll take this scalpel out of your hand. Did so, and I collapsed on the ground. And the demonstrator carried on talking as though I hadn't collapsed at all, because you come to fairly quickly if you faint and collapse on the ground. And so I'd come to, and the demonstrator had completely ignored me on the ground and was just saying, you know, the clavicle joins them up here and so on. And I thought, well, I just better get to my feet again. So I got halfway up, and of course, if you faint, you mustn't get up too quickly. And so I fainted again as I got up. And the demonstrator again didn't do anything about this other than put his foot on my chest. And so he was standing talking to the other medical students with his foot on my chest to keep me on the ground, while he was continuing to say, and the clavicle, you know, joins the sternum here and so on. And I remember this thinking, this is the best treatment I've ever had for fainting, you know, that no one's panicking around and all the rest of it. It's just that I've fainted and I need to lie down flat. And this guy knows this. And what's more, he's not even taking the slightest notice of the fact that I've fainted. He's just carrying on with the demonstration. I never fainted in my life after that. It taught me that actually this is just crazy. But I can remember to this day this guy's foot pushing down on my chest, so there was no question that I could get up for a bit. People used to faint in research. All sorts of pandemoniums broke out. There was lots of politics. People did silly things with gamma counters and so on. Robert was such an enthusiast for doing insulin assays that you needed insulin-free plasma for this. Insulin-free plasma was obviously, you know, the standard against which you check whether insulin's available in other people. So the way you do that is you just get some plasma from normal people. Let's just get some blood, spin the red cells out, take what's left on the top. You put in activated charcoal, that really strips out all the insulin there is, spin it all down, and then you've got your insulin-free plasma. Melanie Burnett, who was one of the MLSOs, the medical scientific officers, on one occasion came up to me and said, look at this blood, what do you think of this? And she got a test tube of blood which had been spun down, and the ratio of the red cells to the to the plasma on the top was all wrong. There were few red cells and a very large amount of plasma. And I said, well, where's that from? Because this person's clearly very anemic. And she said, well, it's from Robert. And so I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, well, we've, you know, taken this blood from Robert for insulin-free plasma, and I've taken 50 mils and all the rest of it. So we then went round and found that all sorts of people in the lab, that Robert was keep on giving blood for this and that and the other, and was having clamps down and all the rest of it. And so went round and discovered that loads of people had been taking blood out of Robert, and actually that we started to bleed him to the point when he was anemic. Went round to Robert and said, do you realise that we've just spun your blood down and you've got a hematocrit? Your hemoglobin is less than 10. And you better go on iron and so on. And I had to go around everyone and say, look, Robert's out of bounds. You can't keep on bleeding the boss because he's got anemic. So that was one of those sort of ludicrous things. I used to give blood for insulin-free plasma as well on occasions. And I remember on one occasion, I put a butterfly into my arm, which is a little needle. And actually, having said I never fainted again, this was the one exception, because I'd got a huge syringe attached to this, having inserted it into my own arm, and was pulling blood out of my own arm using the two hands, but with the butterfly into my forearm. And I suddenly realised that actually I'm going to faint, and this is a crazy thing to do. But of course, knowing what to do is to lie flat on the ground. You can't faint when you're flat on the ground. That was what the anatomy demonstrator taught me. So I lay flat on the ground. And continued to pull the blood out of myself for this insulin-free plasma. And I remember Robert Turner coming in through the laboratory door and seeing me on the ground with a syringe in my hand and a butterfly in my arm, and just looking around the door, seeing me lying there, and then just retreating again on the basis that he wasn't getting, wasn't interested in what was going on, but he certainly wasn't getting involved in that. And I always thought that was fantastic. Thing for the boss to do is to just sort of back out of the door and walk away on the basis of, I don't know what David's doing, but I don't think I want to know.